This is the HOD Hour with Stan Claff.
Good evening, I'm Stan Claff. This is the HOD Hour. For some reason, our intro isn't being played, so I'm going to have to do the intro myself. I think I can manage that. And I have with me in the studio tonight, Jochie Rees. He's a clinical psychologist, a specialist leadership and group facilitator, culture transformation specialist, and a professional musician. So tonight, are we going to talk about the good side that you want to talk about, the professional musician, or are we going to talk about the boring stuff, which is the leadership?
We can even try for a bit of both.
Okay, we'll give you a chance at the end to
create some harmony.
To create some harmony. Also have in the studio tonight with me Natalie Solomon, who helps me to produce the show, brings in people like Jochie to talk to us. And also tonight we have Tabo is pushing all the red buttons and making sure the show continues. Just before we begin, normally I just want to tell you that this afternoon I was at a seminar which was on body language. And so in the show, I must have to tell you, if you were in the studio, you'd see that Natalie is jumping up and down wanting to ask the questions. So I'm reading her body language, and I'm going to try and give her a chance sometime during the show to ask some questions. Okay, let's talk a little bit about Jochie. Jochie, you've been around for quite a long time. You designed and led immersive mindfulness workshops for many large corporations, that's such as Standard Bank, Absa, and Investec. You then helped in the 2012-2014 period, helped Nedbank with their leadership and cultural program, which I presume is partly attributed to their success. And you've pioneered your own methodology, harnessing the science of sound to bypass the distracted and fear-based impulsive rational mind to facilitate greater presence and self-mastery. This helps to unlock authentically self-awareness, creativity, resilience, and peak performance. You founded your own company called Attuned Consulting, which I presume is something to do with the music, in 2014. So, but tonight we're not going to only talk about leadership. We're actually going to go away to a relevant topic today, which is diversity management. Now, this is probably a very special moment in South Africa where the DA, for an example, is undergoing a period of change, and perhaps they should be paying attention to diversity management in order to make themselves a success. But so, understanding diversity management, I just want to know, is this just a way for companies to get around legal action, to avoid the nastiness of discriminatory lawsuits against them, and just package the whole thing in a different way and say, let's call it diversity management, and then we are a diverse organization and nobody can point fingers at us? Or am I reading the signs incorrectly?
I think that it can be seen in an approach in many different ways, but I think that the concept of diversity is so much broader and deeper than just certain policies and the way we try and protect ourselves from, you know, perceived threats around those legal aspects that you mentioned. I think diversity really cuts to the heart of how we operate as a culture. You know, when you talk about culture, organizational culture, company culture, is really your operating system. As great policies and systems as you may have, and technology even, it's not going to achieve the impact that it can and the effectiveness that it can be unless the people and your human capital is supporting it, and the diversity and the creativity and the agility and resilience of your workforce is really the most critical aspect. And it's been shown in the research time and time again over the last many years now how critical culture is. In fact, so much so that it's recently been said that culture has to now come out of the pigeonhole of HR and become a leader, you know, driven priority, because your culture is literally your operating system.
So I understand the background to it. I understand the need for it, because obviously we live in a society which is very diverse, both racially and, of course, gender-wise and age-wise and all otherwise. And you're in a company, you're in a big company. So if I look at your clients, Standard Bank, Absa, Nedbank, these are people that can afford the time, they can afford the effort, and they can afford really to manage this process. And I suppose it's not an overnight business. This is is something which takes time. Mm-hmm. And if you're talking about Nedbank, they're only starting to show positive results now after a number of years of undergoing this process. So take us through a little bit of what's the beginning point. What, you look at your company, you've got a whole lot of employees, and now they're all diverse, and you want to try to get the most out of it. So you want it to be productive, and you don't want people pointing fingers and racial slurs and all the type of feminist things and grudging participation in everything. So where do we go?
Yeah, so, you know, in our context in South Africa, diversity has a unique level of complexity and challenge to it because of our history and because of the wounds and scars that sit deep within the psyches on each side. And that whole layer, because it's so hot and volatile and unpredictable as well and scary to go into, you know, to work at, it's often left and kind of squashed, as it were, under the rug. And the problem is that that's energy that does not disappear, that continues to bubble. It's like a pressure cooker. You can put a lid on it, but after a while, it's going to bubble and bubble and bubble. And if you don't address it, and if you don't find ways to create the safety and the containment to allow people to be real and to have the real, honest, difficult conversations with each other, unless you do that, then you're going to constantly have the seething underground bubbling of all sorts of stuff that's going to hijack the surface level priorities of a company and team. And this is very tricky because it requires, you know, to do this work, if you're going to go in there and you're going to get into the, what you can almost call the guts of the team, you need to know what you're doing and you need to have the experience and training and the ability to hold that kind of conversation. So one of the amazing experts in working with diversity and conflict in the world, his name is Arnold Mandel. He's a psychologist, a Jungian psychologist who's also a quantum physicist. And he kind of combined Jung's concept of the shadow, which is really the unconscious, the hidden stuff of our psyche. And he applied that to an organization and a group level and in the quantum sort of lens to understand that even the things that happen at a micro level affect the macro and vice versa. And he speaks really of the methodology that he developed is called either process work or process oriented psychology. It's also called deep democracy. And deep democracy is an incredible term because normally democracy means just the majority voice and we value the majority voice. But deep democracy implies that every voice in a system has wisdom. And not only that, he taught, but even, in fact, specifically the minority voice, the voice that is most squashed and marginalized in any system, often has the greatest wisdom of that system. Examples if we look at how for so long leadership specifically and society as a whole has been dominated by patriarchal influences, and now what we see in leadership research is the most important critical things for effective dynamic leaders are emotional intelligence, vulnerability, authenticity, intuition. You know, these are more relatively feminine qualities that have really come to the fore and the wisdom of that minority voice. Another example is extroverts and introverts. You know, in many ways in Western society, extroverts are favored. They're more seductive. We kind of tend to really, give more airtime to them, and often they dominate. They're more easily able to speak and more confident and can take up space in a room. And what we don't realize is we lose the wisdom of the introverts. You know, extroverts think when they speak. Introverts speak before they speak. And there's a lot of nuanced, detailed information and wisdom that introverts have, which the extroverts and all their noise and kind of, you know, busyness don't even pick up on. And often the things that the introverts are aware of and tuned into are the very things that can make or break a whole project or system or enterprise. But the thing with power or rank, which is one of the big things that this Arnold Mandel speaks about, is that power and rank is not is not good or bad. It just is. It's a reality of life. There's many different types and forms of power. And it's only when we become conscious of the power that each of us has, and we can then use our power in a conscious, positive way, that's what determines whether we use our power positively or not. But in and of itself, it's not positive or negative. So just to illustrate this, there's an amazing quote of Arnold Mandela. I just want to read this to you, and think about the context of South Africa when I read this, the short quote of his to you. If all the oppressed were to move forward and all the oppressors were to step down, chances are the world would not change in a sustainable way. Why? Because one power was blindly replaced with another. Only when all members of a community grow in awareness of power in themselves and others can true change occur. So that's a very deep statement. I mean, what that implies is that even the oppressed, as powerless as they may feel, have forms of power. And we can talk about that a little bit later. I can give an illustration within a corporate environment that really illustrates that very, very nicely, and how that plays out and how we can apply it on a more practical level.
But actually, what you're talking about is how, to begin with diversity, you have to begin with self-enlightenment.
Right.
That actually, before you look out, you need to look in.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Diversity, you know, all leadership really is self-leadership, because how can you lead anyone else if you can't lead yourself? And, you know, it's been shown that EQ, emotional intelligence, which is really based on emotional self-awareness, because I can only manage my emotions intelligently if I'm aware of them. So the whole basis of emotional intelligence is really self-awareness, so that I can manage my emotions intelligently. And a leader, culture flows from the top. It always flows from the leadership, and the level of your diversity, health in your system will in many ways be coming from the top, and how open and self-aware and able to be in touch with the diversity within themselves the leaders are of that system. You know, so diversity starts on the most basic level with, what's the diversity in me? The different parts of me. You know, there's an inner diversity. Every one of us human beings is a whole microcosmic universe. And this is a very fundamental principle in all spiritual traditions, actually. You know, we have all different, you know, we normally just live and inhabit the attic of our being, our head. We're so stuck in the noise and constant kind of, torrents of our mind. But there's other parts of our being, our heart, our emotions, the energy that gives us, our intuition, our body, and even other dimensions. And so it really does start from the inside out, as Natalie said. And, what you really need, ideally, to get diversity in your culture right, is you need a leadership that supports what it takes and what it's going to require to invest to get that culture, and specifically in the area of diversity, which is particularly complex and sensitive, as we mentioned.
So you can't walk in, you own this big company, or even if you own a small company, and one day you walk in and say, right, today's the day for diversity management. We're going to change the whole culture of this business. We're wiping the slate clean. Everybody's gray. They're not black, or they're not white. They're all cross-gender. They're everything.
So you see,
and suddenly the magic wand, and we're all stepping back and forget about, leave your ego at the door.
Yeah.
And now we're going to start. That's where we're going to start, and we're going to build this thing. And I'm going to listen to you, and you're going to listen to me.
Yeah. And I mean, that's a great ideal. It's to get there. You know, first of all, I mean, to say that we're not going to judge and we're all equal is not really real. You know, I often say, you know, whoever says, people like to say, I don't judge, I'm not a judgmental person. If you say that, you're lying, because if you're a human being, you are a judgmental creature. The way your brain processes and makes sense of the world is inherently judgmental. And again, that's not good or bad. It just is. It's a reality. And we can only use our, you know, discriminating ability and judgment ability positively by being conscious of how we judge and how we fear other, and how, you know, we all have jokes about other cultures. You know, literally every culture has jokes about other cultures. That's just a reality. And that's okay if we can just be real about it and allow ourselves slowly to have the courage to challenge those judgments and fears.
But isn't a joke kind of a way of breaking the ice?
Absolutely. But it also can be a defense. So it often is about the degree, you know. So someone who, think of Robin Williams, great case in point, you know, someone who has to be happy all the time, and may be amazing and brilliant at it and get lots of, you know, acknowledgement and affirmation for it. But sometimes if the person can only be, or the team and group can only be, you know, funny and, all the time and can't drop to a deeper level, what, you have to ask what's going on there. Is that a defense in any way? So absolutely, humor, you know, humor is not in and of itself a defense, but how it's used. And it's amazing how the humor kind of often does become a buffer for the authentic, feelings and thoughts that we have when it comes to diversity. So it's scary to say it directly, but we may use humor and jokes as a way to kind of, you know, express certain things. And as the saying goes, many a truth is said in jest, you know, it often is the case.
My sense is that with diversity, it would often, the defenses that are typically used would be either avoidance or kind of a wish to make play nice.
Yeah. And or, that aggression.
Actually, or aggression. But that actually the stuff is messy.
Yeah.
So what does one need to enter into this messy space? What equips you?
Great question. So, you know, one of the, if you're interested, by the way, in a great book on that, there's one of the many books of this Arnold Mandel. Mandel is spelled M-I-N-D-E-L-L. One of his earlier books, quite a bit earlier, is called Sitting in the Fire. And it's an incredible, title and metaphor. And really the metaphor is that until, as different human beings, we learn to sit in the heat and the fire of having those authentic, hard, courageous conversations, then we're never really going to cross that bridge ultimately and be able to create something new and beautiful. It's almost like if you think of fire, you know, in a crucible, you know, someone who, a goldsmith who's fashioning something beautiful. You know, fire can be destructive, but, and it can be hot and uncomfortable, but it also can create beauty. Something can emerge out of that heat. And it's a metaphor that he uses, which I think is so important for us. You know, I think in South Africa, we are at a stage where there is so much fear and judgment and the narratives and the implosions on social media. There's, you know, it's like, and when I say this, I mean, I want to be really clear that diversity is so much more than just race and gender. It's, and we can speak a little bit about that. But, because it's so hot in our history and, you know, it's like the landscape is filled with like methylated spirits. It just takes one tiny little, you know, spark and things can be absolutely inflammatory and escalate and, you know, in really hectic ways. So in terms of what's required is really, that's what I was saying earlier on, the safety and the containment. So there are processes, you know, facilitators, specialist facilitators and group facilitators and team coaches who work with groups, and have had a level of training to be able to hold a conversation that goes into those difficult waters and territory. You know, that's the time is needed, the space is needed, the experts' facilitation is needed, and very much, as we said before, the buy-in and the being led by the leader, you know, and almost starting on the leadership level, like Nedbank's whole transformation process started with Mike Brown. It was actually Mike
Not
Brown.
Tom Boardman.
It was Tom Boardman was the original, correct. Sorry. It started with Tom Boardman and his Exco team. And was led from that top, down. And so that's a model that works, you know, because then it's coming from the top. There's the buy-in, there's the investment. And it's not the leader saying, you know, this is something you guys must do, you know, come to this workshop on diversity and we're going to sort this out. It's modeled. And that's really, you know, why value-based leadership is so huge at the moment. It has been for actually quite a long time. You know, values is something that has to be lived. You know, you can have them on your wall, you can have the blueprint and the DNA, and you can have all the espoused values, but unless it's lived and actually embodied and first and foremost modeled from the leadership level, you're not really going to have that buy-in and really an integration, you know, in your culture.
So. But I'm a company director, and my whole aim in life is to make money. I'm not interested in whether you're black, white, colored, male or female, you want to produce for me to make money and for the company to go ahead. So I'm starting at a point now where you're taking away the central core of my business and you're saying, we want to talk about diversity management. How do we marry the two together to say, this is what we're trying to achieve. Do you as a company member buy into that process? And is diversity management going to now help us get there?
Yeah, you know, it's what you talk of, the bottom line. You know, it's kind of what I was mentioning earlier on, that often the bottom line is and has to be the concern in a business. But you know, the real bottom line, as in your human beings that make up your whole organization. What is an organization? It's really a collective of individuals, and the effectiveness and success of your enterprise and organization is going to be an amalgam of the collective levels of engagement of all the people in your system. And so it's a known thing that, you know, disengaged employees cost hundreds of billions of dollars, and, you know, equivalents scaled down in South Africa. The stats are all out there, and, you know, the turnover levels, the absenteeism, all of those signs and symptoms that employees aren't necessarily engaged. So, you know, yes, the bottom line is important, but what's going to give you that bottom line and rise in your bottom line is the level of how engaged and happy, you know, what culture is really how we do things. It's the how. You know, normally our focus is always on the what, the product, the deliverables. The culture is how we do things and how things are done here. And engagement is how we feel as staff about how things are done here.
And when you come to work as an employee and into an organization like this, so I'm presuming that the diversity side of this is the management of it, is to try and make you relevant. So you want to come into the workplace knowing that you have a place, knowing that you're putting forward the company policy, or you're advancing the company in some way.
Yeah.
You're a value to the company. Mm. And how do I, I'm the board member of a big organization. I sit in the boardroom. And yes, everybody's on the same page because we're all making money. We're looking at the share price and it's going up and everybody's happy.
Mm.
But underneath there's a rumbling because this guy doesn't like that guy and that
right.
department won't work with him. And that person, it's like, you know, you won't go to that shul because it's across the road from the shul where you used to go. And so how do we create that harmony?
Yeah.
I mean, this has got to be a minefield.
Yeah. It really is. And, you know, often the strategy is to just ignore. You know there's rumblings. We sense there's something. People can often feel it in the room. You know, you can cut the atmosphere mm-hmm. with a knife sometimes in terms of where that can get to. But it's a scary place to go to. It's scary for leaders too, specifically because, you know, if you do an intervention with, you know, it's facilitated with a leader and a team, the leader has to really be courageous and vulnerable to open up and to take the bullets of feedback, you know.
And he's probably got years of built-in prejudices and built-in ways of doing things.
And
doing it now, suddenly he's confronted with a whole different set of circumstances.
And also the conditioning that you're supposed to somehow be perfect as a human being, which is already a crazy assumption and belief, but especially as a leader, you know, leaders expect themselves somehow or conditioned into thinking that they have to be absolutely perfect all the time. And so to have feedback around what's not working and to honestly invite that, that's a difficult thing. It's really almost putting yourself on the line.
Is it a kind of a carrot and a stick? You will do it? Or is it a carrot where you're going to say, listen, if you do this, this is what will happen, taking us through the process. So there's got to be, I know I've seen many companies when it's the stick culture.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't do it, you're out, or they'll make it difficult for you or whatever it is.
Yeah.
There's other companies where you go in there and you can feel it's palpable that, you know, there's a harmony. People, despite who they are attending to the customer. They're doing what is right. Everybody's
together.
On board.
Yeah.
And that's obviously the carrot culture. So,
well, it's funny you say that because there's an amazing motivational expert. His name is Dan Pink. He's got a great TED talk called The Puzzle of Human Motivation. And what he says is that he differentiates between what's called extrinsic motivation or external motivation and intrinsic internal motivation. And he says that most companies actually are still stuck in the outdated, outmoded model of extrinsic motivation, which he calls the carrot and stick model, meaning that either will, you know, if you don't perform adequately, we'll performance manage you out in the stick. If you do perform better, we'll give you more money and financial incentive. That's the carrot. But he said both of those have been shown not to necessarily work, even extra financial incentive. There's a study in the London School of Economics that showed that an increased financial incentive could possibly have a negative impact. Why? Because it's still external. And what you want and what you need to create is internal motivation in your employees. How do you create that? So he says there's three pillars. The three pillars are autonomy, mastery, and purpose. So autonomy is do I have a say in my work trajectory, in my, you know, in what, in where I can go and what I'm exposed to? Can I participate in my discussions around my work roles and all of that? Do I have a voice in that? You know,
think, well, and will somebody listen?
And will someone listen? Exactly. Am I respected and valued to even hear my voice and have my voice be heard? And then mastery is being able to get good at what really matters to me, what's really important to me. So can I have development opportunities and have exposure to things that are going to be important to me in terms of what I'm passionate about and where I want to advance in my career? Again, is that agency in me directing somehow my path? The world of work has changed dramatically since a few decades ago, where it was just enough to have a job and then it was just enough to have a career. Now it's almost like, as a psychologist, Murray Stain, who says that it's the opus. We want to leave our mark in our work. We want meaning, we want depth, we want purpose. It's not enough just to even have a career now, but it's like, I want my career path to be meaningful, to be something that really resonates with me and that I can drive and direct and be part of. And then purpose is whatever I'm doing somehow to have a connection with the bigger picture on some level. So one, you know, example is, if I'm selling a bank product, if I'm selling a home loan or credit or whatever it is, am I just selling, you know, a home loan, or am I helping people to realize their dreams and to build families?
Or do I want to just see the check in my bank at the end of the month?
Yeah. You know, so, and of course that's a harder element to sometimes have, but it's important as well.
But I guess what Stan was saying, can I afford to do diversity training? And the question really is, can I afford not to?
Yeah. You know, it's kind of like, this area of investment in your staff and really in your whole kind of company's operating system, as we said, culture work, this is often one of the first areas that is cut when times are hard. And it really it makes no sense. As you say, Natalie, it should be the last thing, because the message you're giving your staff, if you're cutting development for your staff, is what you're really saying is, guys, when times are hard, we want you to work harder with less investment. It makes no sense. The message that you really want to try and give to your staff is that, guys, we're still going to take care of you even in these difficult times. We're with you still. And, you know, keep the development of your morale, because it's been shown and proven that those companies that can keep the morale and the engagement of their staff during the difficult times, when the economy recovers, that's when they really thrive. If they can keep that culture intact and that feeling of, you know, we do still care for you, we do still value you, that's a huge element. So, you know, it doesn't have to be huge expenditure. In fact, even just spending on the senior management, executive management level in itself will be a massive impact value, because the shifts that will happen at that level, your exec level or senior management level, will ripple out into your whole system.
Well, what does that look like? Because I think sometimes diversity feels soft or airy-fairy.
Yeah.
Pragmatically, what does that look like?
So, you know, it really involves a number of different things, but ideally, you know, in my experience, it involves taking groups of people on journeys, on an actual process and an experiential workshop where they can learn to understand, first and foremost, the diversity in themselves more, to understand, you know, there's research now that our gut is called the second brain. Mm-hmm. It's called the enteric nervous system. I mean, not to gross you out, but if you think of the tissue of the gut and the folds and the brain's cortex, they're actually very similar even anatomically. And there's research now, there's hard science, that your gut is a brain. Mm-hmm. So you know the saying, trust your gut, trust your intuition. You know that when you don't trust it, often you regret it, because it was often spot on. And there's now hard science to that. You know, most of our serotonin is produced there. There's millions and billions of nerve cells all around there. And that's why it's been shown in leadership. You know, as a leader, your task is to make a decision. Someone has to make a call at times where you won't have all the information and details at your fingertips and at your disposal, but you still have to make a call. And if you can't use your intuition at all and you aren't tuned into that part of your being, not just your head, there's going to be problems, and that's why it's been shown to be so valuable. So first of all, starting with the inside level, with you know, individuals starting to understand the diversity within themselves, the diversity within each other in terms of personality. Personality is a great aspect of diversity, which really highlights for us how there's no one or other personality that's better than another one. It's really each personality type brings gold aspects and incredible gifts, and each type can have shadow aspects if it's not conscious and if it's blind. You know, it's just this flip side of the coin for each type. And so it's about starting to understand. So you start with giving people frameworks that is not just theoretical, but that they are applying, that they work with, that they discuss with themselves, that they discuss in small groups, bigger groups, sharing, reflecting individual exercises, and then coming back into the group. And in that way, you start giving people frameworks to start have awareness. Once you have that first level, which already can, you know, take at least, or should take at least around a day or so, you can then move into another day process where you start to have actual conversations. But now people have been equipped with the tools to process the difficult stuff that comes up. And you give them these conversation tools as well, how to have difficult conversations and courageous conversations. And you give people structures that help diffuse and de-escalate when things start to. You know, what happens often is that, you know, we collapse the data, the feelings, and the interpretation in one. So we say, you know, you came late for the meeting, and, you know, I'm absolutely mad at you, and you just don't give a damn about anyone else. You know, where we can teach people to learn to separate what actually happened, it's just the pure fact and data, from the feeling that I feel about that, to the meaning that I give to interpreting what happened. And to realize that that meaning and interpretation is mine. There may be other, you know, contexts and factors at play. And so there's ways that you start to give people lenses and frameworks and tools to start to be able to actually start having those conversations. And very importantly, you have to first give people a tryout of those conversations in the workshop where there are facilitators, so that when things do erupt, as they will, because it needs to be authentic and real, the facilitator is there to contain and to hold and to support that.
That sounds highly complex.
And then it can be generalized and taken into the workplace and grown out of it.
That sounds very complex, but at its very basic level. Well, so I want to try and illustrate two points that are...
Sure.
A long time ago, there was a... Right in the beginning, at the end of apartheid, in the beginning of... New South Africa, so to speak, there was an announcer called Justice Chungu. I don't know if you would remember him. A bit young for that. So are you, Natalie. So are you, Tabu.
Outnumbered, guys.
But Justice Chungu was on SABC. But he came to talk to the HRD, one of our lectures in the early days, in the late 80s. And he said, you know, it's a funny thing. He says, you will go to the station or you'll go to work and you'll see early in the morning, you're going to work and people are running. They just want to get to work. And he says, so they get into work and it's 8 o'clock. They run into the door. They come, they take their jacket, put it on the chair, and now they sit down. Well, they've achieved the objective because the boss said, you will be at 8 o'clock. Now, you know, so now what's the rest of the day going to bring me? And, that's played on my mind a lot because, you know, in my work and wherever I've been, I've tried to think about that. You know, does the person working with me or who I'm working with, do they have a purpose? And it brings me, I used to be in the building industry and we were building a high rise building. At that time I worked for a big company and we were building a high rise building and, we brought the staff and of course laborers, everybody doing work and they dug holes and they built foundations and whatever. And then one day it occurred to me, you know, I don't know if these people know what we're doing. Do they actually know what we're building? They're digging a hole. They're pouring concrete in it. They're pouring another slab, whatever it is. So I got the architect to draw a perspective and I put it on the wall and I called them all around to the site and I said, this is what we're building. And here's the floors and this is where we are. And every week we used to have a look at the progress. And you know what? What came forward out of that discussion, and it was a simple step, really.
Yeah,
it was like
20
minutes, 15 minutes or whatever it is of time. What came out were ideas and a shift in thinking and people coming forward with ideas. Why can't we do it this way?
Yeah.
Can we finish this floor by this and can we do that? And so I think that what you're trying to engender into people is some sort of participation rather than, than feeling that they're instructed.
Well, that's what I was saying, to bring their voice in, to feel that my voice is being heard. And what you're illustrating is an incredible illustration of something that's quite eerie. You mentioned that story. Cause I was going to say before when we spoke about purpose, I gave the example of the home loan, you know, and is it just a home loan or helping people achieve their dreams? Another example is, you know, there were two guys with those machines drilling holes in the ground. What are they called? Those, I can't remember, called
breakers.
Those breakers or
concrete breakers.
Concrete breakers, and you know, there's two guys drilling, and they're building, you know, this building, this high-rise building, and they're standing, you know, 5 meters away from each other, and a guy goes to the one guy and he says, "What are you doing?" And he says, "I'm digging a hole." And then he walks to the next guy who's 5 meters away, and he says, "What are you doing?" And he says, "I'm building a skyscraper."
Hmm.
And your perspective, and you know, what are you connecting with in what you're doing? That purpose, that vision, that meaning, you know. And I think the story you gave completely illustrates that in a real way.
On the other hand, there were two guys digging the street, and a guy sitting in his hotel room. He's looking up in the street. He sees two guys digging holes, and he eventually one digs the hole, the other one fills it. Digs the hole, fills it, go down the road. Can't stand it anymore. He goes across there and he says, "Excuse me, I've been watching you for the last hour. You dig the holes, you fill the holes. What are you doing?" He says, "The guy that's supposed to plant the tree didn't pitch today."
But that's exactly, it's making meaning. It's drawing the connections, and it's recognizing that each person brings value, and letting them know that they're seen. I think that often people just feel like a cog in the machine, but so much more value is taken out when you're seen.
We have such one of the core, most core needs as human beings is to be seen, is to be affirmed, is to be, you know, right from the beginning. You know, it's how we're born in the world and how we learn, and we have mirror neurons, and it's so deeply wired in us. And it does, you know, recognition doesn't have to be massive things like cruises and gifts, and it can be small things. It can be just acknowledging people in front of the group, you know, in meetings, small gestures. There's many ways. It doesn't have to be loud and flashy and expensive, but it makes such a difference when people feel heard. You know, I mentioned earlier on, I was going to give an example in the corporate space of what happens when there's a blockage of energy. I spoke about that model that this Arnold Mundell has, which is really a kind of a psychodynamic model applying the unconscious that you normally apply on an individual when you work with someone in therapy, if you use that lens, applying that to an organization. So what's unconscious in the organization? What voices are not being given expression? And so a great illustration of what can happen, or what can typically happen, is where people don't feel that their voice is heard, like we've been discussing now. And what can start to happen is that there's this barrier, there's this huge barrier where people on the ground are working, and you know, I have feedback that I want to give the leadership in terms of, because I'm customer facing and I'm on the ground and reality level, and there's certain things that I'm seeing that I want the leadership to know about so that they can make certain changes that will help the ground level. But what often happens is that there's the either reality or just the perception, or somewhere in between, that there's that the leadership don't want to hear what the people on the ground have to say.
Probably they don't.
Well, yeah, it's either the reality, sadly, or it's a perception. And sometimes they are willing to, but the workers on the ground, as it were, haven't built the courage to actually really test that out. And actually, you know, a lot of the fears that we have are just in our head. You know, when you're in a mode of fear, you're in an irrational mode. The writer George Bernard Shaw, he said a great line. He said, "My life has been a series of catastrophes, most of which have never happened." And it's amazing how bizarrely irrational our thinking can get when we're in a mode of fear. But so sometimes it's a perception and not even real. But what happens is there tends to be this barrier. And then what happens is that there's rumbling. So there's anger, there's frustration. So the workforce is trying to express, you know, and give actual data. You know, if it's in an IT context, I have actual data that I want to give to the leadership, but that feels like they don't want to hear that. And so what happens is that it's like that pressure cooker metaphor we gave earlier on. It builds and builds and builds and builds. And at some level, that's going to leak. It's going to leak out. And examples of where it leaks out is either, you know, look, in radical extreme cases, people can just lose their, you know, and, you know, someone can walk into the office with a weapon or do something crazy. But usually it's more kind of, it leaks in kind of safer spaces. So when people are in small groups, in the parking lots, in the lunch areas, you know, with their friends, and the energy leaks there. So the frustration and the anger, you know, and what starts to happen, you see, instead of taking that energy and using it to unite and discuss together, okay, how can we present this to leadership in a way that they will be open and listen and hear us? How do we first start by saying what is working and thank them for what they're doing as leadership to try and help us and acknowledge what is right? And then when there's some receptivity, to try and say, you know, but what really might work differently is, so instead of taking the energy and using it to discuss together, to strategize, to support each other in numbers, because then it is safer to approach management. It's very scary for a lone wolf to go, but if, you know, we kind of unite together, it's a lot easier. Instead of that, what happens is the energy gets wasted. So yes, there's a relief, and it's very seductive to get, you know, oh, the leadership, they're such, you know, idiots, and, you know, they're such morons. I just don't want to listen to us. They don't give a damn. They're just in their forms. So you start to have these kind of narratives that form. And yes, in the short term, there's a relief because the frustration and the anger gets vented. But there's such a, number one, waste of energy that happens there. But number two, it actually creates a narrative of disempowerment. So we start to talk of ourselves as being powerless and not, you know, this victim mentality that we can't do anything to change the bigger picture and we're powerless. And it actually re-entrenches and actually maintains that status quo often instead of moving it forward. So you see what this illustrates is an amazing illustration of what that quote that we said earlier on by Arnold Mundell, because what this shows is that both sides do have power. Management have power in their privilege and in their rank and in their ease and access and resources and ability to make their voice heard, because for them to speak, it's very easy in the leadership position. You know, it says a leader whispers and people hear a roar. You know, it's easy to speak as a leader. You have that that ease and privilege. But as staff, especially as individuals, it's very hard. But what is the power that the disempowered staff level do have? Well, the power they have is the vision, the line of sight of the reality, the information and the awareness and the wisdom of what's happening on the ground level. That's a power which the leadership don't have. They're in their ivory tower, they're making their decisions, they've got their privilege, their rank, but they don't have line of sight of what's happening on the ground. And so if the people on the ground could just appreciate the power that they have, and own that and acknowledge that and rather use the energy to constructively work with the kinds of tools like I was describing before that can be given, then you can change the whole landscape. You can, instead of having fear barriers and obstructions and rumblings and, you know, conflictual dynamics and power games and a mess in your system, you can start to have, you know, moving from the me to the we, to really have that group collective synergy and engagement and connection and participation and creativity and innovation and, you know, cross-pollination and really amazing debate and dialogue. But that's where that's the paradox of where diversity and conflict actually, you know, diversity as in creativity and enrichment, not just one way, but multicolor, harmony, whatever metaphor you want to use, that only can come through conflict. So conflict is a given. Whenever you have a group of human beings, you're going to have conflict. It's not good or bad. It's how we manage the conflict.
Is it not safety within conflict, that you need safety first?
Absolutely.
In order to allow yourself to go into. So how does one create cultures of safety so one can be courageous?
Absolutely. So there's many different ways that we can really start to create that feeling of, you know, the safety really, number one, is modeled by how the leadership runs these processes and values people and invites people to speak and but also the safety in terms of creating and learning how to create the containment and safety in your environment. It's very much often about boundaries as well, because that's why I said earlier on, when to have those difficult conversations, there's a structure that you need, because when things get uncontained, we need to learn how to contain them. That to learn that, just instead of catastrophizing and getting to the drama of, oh my gosh, we're going to kill each other here. No, we can have a hard, difficult, tough conversation, uncomfortable conversation, and still survive and still grow and still be enriched by each other, you know. And so that takes investment and time to be able to develop the qualities that are needed to create that safety and those boundaries. You know, boundary comes from, you know, it ranges from our identity and who we are and who our company is and who our team is versus other teams, and really so and to have those discussions held consensually and where everyone can contribute, so that there's buy-in into this, you know, identity of who we are, and is that fluid, and is there space to speak about that, and even the difficult things that are hard to speak about, failure and embarrassment and vulnerability and mistakes and politics politics and, you know, all of those things that the undiscussables, the difficult.
But are these companies open to this type of situation?
So this is
type of process.
This is, right. So this is the real question, you know, because there isn't unfortunately a shortcut. The only way, that's why, you know, that title that I mentioned of Mandel, the Sitting in the Fire, is such a great title because it requires the courage and the right environment, as we said, the safety, but it really requires the willingness and being prepared to be vulnerable. And we don't like being vulnerable. There's a great TED talk by this amazing woman, Brené Brown, called The Power of Vulnerability. It's one of the most watched TED talks of all time. It's like 45 million views or something like that. And she just explains so amazingly how, as a society in the West, specifically, we hate vulnerability and we're told and conditioned that vulnerability is weakness. So there's a lot of unlearning that we have to do to be able to tolerate those difficult, vulnerable spaces. You know, there's an amazing statement by a futurologist. His name is Alvin Toffler. He wrote a book called Future Shock. And he said that the illiterate of the 21st century will not be those who can't read or write. It will be those who can't learn, unlearn, and relearn. And as we become more automated as like a, you know, a human race, especially by technology and AI, it's more and more important to learn how to unlearn and relearn. So when it comes to core beliefs that we hold very deeply around vulnerability, that's a deep thing. And we have very deep beliefs that are passed down culturally, you know, cross-generationally, and in all sorts of different contexts that vulnerability, you know, I must be strong, I mustn't be weak. And unless we learn to tolerate vulnerability, we can't really be authentic, as she says in that video, in that TED talk. We can't, you know, the key to authentic connection, which is what diversity is all about. If you think of the differences of people and the diversity in your system as almost hooks that can actually join us together, it's about connections. How do we connect and enrich each other through the opposite energy of conflict? You know, it's like, any creation, if you think in the universe on a metaphysical level, is from opposites coming together. Male, female in biology, in electricity, positive, negative, you know, physics, binary in computers. It's an amazing thing. There's a contemporary philosopher, McIntyre, who said the moment any institution, say a medical institution or educational institution, stops rigorously debating, fiercely debating what that ideal institution should look like, it's dead. Because the vigorous debate gives it life. It's the conflict that creates energy, that creates movement, that creates growth, not stagnation and fossilizing.
So we're coming now, unfortunately, to the end. I mean, it's been fascinating, but we'll probably talk for another hour, and I can see Natalie's got a million questions, unanswered questions we're going to debate in the car park. And that's something in a big company, you want to join the smokers because they go out together and have a chat.
Well, that's another whole conversation. It's true. You know, even that and golf too, you know, the sports, you know, sure. What about people who don't play golf and who, you know, there's
and
so much, and who don't smoke. There's so much networking that happens in those spaces. And this is why we need to be conscious about, you know, the different types of rank, because there's privilege in those networking spaces. That's when we talk about rank. Mandel always says, whenever you have rank, rank is fluid and contextual. It can, as a white male, if I walk in one context, I can have incredible rank just by being a white male. And if I walk into another context, I can have absolutely no rank. And so too with all the other categories. Rank and power is our privilege in a particular system relative to others in that system. And so we really just need to learn how to be able to understand and appreciate and have conversations and be conscious of the different types of power that we have and, you know, explore those and get beyond just the gender and racial aspects, because then we really start to have those really real important conversations that are necessary to move forward.
Okay, so we've covered all the heavy stuff and, so, Jochie Rees, you're
thank you for having me.
And thank you for coming here, but just in the last few minutes, just give your musicality a punt. I know I've listened to you with my friend Khoni G, doing Havdalah and, also your Sabata. What is the?
Sababa.
Sababa.
Yeah.
Which is in Hebrew cool, I guess, or great or something.
Might even be Arabic.
Arabic, but
that's Akhla, actually. I stand for correction there, sir. But yeah, the music is a big gift. And
your first love.
Funnily enough, talk about rank and different types of privilege. The gift and rank of being a musician is a huge rank. And it took me so long to become conscious of that rank. People would say to me after the performance, you know, you're so brilliant, you're so gifted, you've got such an amazing. And I would say, no, it wasn't really that great. I kind of like, and it took me a while until I started learning these concepts and working with them to realize that this is crazy. It's a huge rank and privilege and power to have music and the skill of music and to be able to touch and move people in such a way. And this person's coming to tell me that I have this, and I'm making as if I don't even have it. And to learn to just say thank you was one of the most amazing lessons to own my rank as a musician. But music is a very big passion and love of mine, and I'm very blessed to have it. I use it actually in the corporate work as well, in mindfulness. So one of the ways that I help teach people, for example, to come into contact with the different elements of diversity in themselves is through using sound meditations and sound journeys. So I have different instruments.
Don't tell me you have drum workshops.
Not drum, but things like singing bowls and rainmakers and chimes and all sorts of exotic,
I'm not going to another drum workshop.
No, this is not drums, but it's an interesting way. I call them my arsenal of weapons of mass construction. It's a way to really give people a deep experience where they connect with the different aspects of themselves. So that's a passion of mine that I like doing, and hence the name Attuned Consulting you were asking earlier.
So Natalie, come on, you've surely got something to say at the end of this, some words of wisdom. Silence. Body language says no. Yeah.
Silence is the gateway to wisdom, by the way. Literally, silence is, it says in the sages, ethics of our fathers in Pirkei Avot, it says, Siag l'chokhma shtika, the gateway to wisdom is silence. Because, if you're talking, you're not learning. If you're listening,
you remain silent and look intelligent.
Excellent.
You can, what did they say? Remain silent and everybody thinks you're a fool. Open your mouth and confirm it.
Confirm it, yeah, yeah.
So thank you very much, Yochi. Thank you very much, Natalie.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Tabu. And I want to wish everybody a good Yontav. The Yom Tav Yom Ha'Ova. But not good Yontav. I want to wish everybody good Shabbos. And the rest of the year, only 67 or 68, 68 days left in the year. So we best make the most of it. And thanks for coming in and sharing your wisdom. And I'm sure we're going to talk about other subjects at some point in the future.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a great pleasure.
You.